I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. The picture coming out of China next week will be something new in the world. Presidents Xi and Trump, East and West, meeting as equals. Or is it two pictures, really? Already a single Chimerica, one humongous joint stock company of banks and factories, with the ultra-high tech and science behind them to run the last details of life and work on this planet for the foreseeable future. But you can see as well a Chutopia dystopia, two outsized, codependent monopoly powers, the yin and yang of overproduction and overconsumption, and two leaders with chips on all four shoulders. Mr. Trump is angry, embarrassed, he says, about a horrible mismatch in trade. Mr. Xi is all but openly impatient to liberate the Western Pacific from the U.S. Navy. Not to argue this hour who's number one or two, or even who looks more like the future when those two principals shake hands in Beijing. For the historian Bill Kirby and the former ambassador Chaz Freeman and other close watchers in the U.S. and in China, my question this hour is, in the radical turmoil of our politics and theirs, what if something new and unnamed is taking shape? I thought I saw it in a picture from China this week, ahead of President Trump's arrival. Two tiers of about 40 super technologists, ours and theirs, Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Ma, Elon Musk, Google, Apple, all of them towing the line in a photo op with Xi Jinping. What if altogether they are the power in our lives, in our world? Bill Kirby, get us started. You're back and forth to China every month or two as the Harvard Business School's eye on Chinese enterprise, old and new. Your new book 2 years ago, we talked about it here, was Can China Lead? What does that picture tell you?
Well, Chris, thanks. This picture tells me that in many areas, China is leading. You have in this picture an extraordinary array of American CEOs, Tim Cook, of course, from Apple, John Thornton, former co-president of Goldman Sachs, Steve Schwarzman from Blackstone, Mark Zuckerberg. You have an incredible array of Chinese technology leaders, but you also have in it people who have been leading major Chinese companies in and outside of China for a very long time. Victor Feng, who established a logistics company, Li and Feng, or led a logistics company that has changed the way goods work around the world. Or a woman named Marjorie Young in this picture, who is the leader of a 100-year-old textile family, makes half of the upper-end men's shirts in the world. This tells me that China is leading in many areas and bringing the leaders of enterprise to China, but it is building on a century of foundation of leadership.
We'll get to that century, but just the spectacle and the stage managing, the bringing those heads together, that's an assignment that would take years to plan it.
And yet it happens every year. Most of these same people will gather every year at the advisory board of the Tsinghua University School of Economics and Management, the single most difficult business school to get into in the world, and the place that is an extraordinary place to incubate the next generation of Chinese and international talent.
The other important little point here, that all of those people really are state monopolists or private monopolists, including our beloved Facebook, Google, Amazon, companies that would have been broken up by now if we had antitrust policy anymore. They're not the kinds of companies that really innovate or disrupt anymore. They're sitting on giant mountains of gold.
Well, that may be, although they certainly have had their innovative moments. And with the iPhone 10 about to come out, I won't comment on innovation in that realm. But at the same time, you have companies that are, you know, if you just take Google as a quasi-monopolist in this country, at least in search engine, and yet, of course, it can't do any business in China because it's blocked by a much more powerful and much more intrusive government vis-a-vis business than we have.
Talk about what Xi and Mr. Trump have to talk about here, including, for example, trade, which is a tough one, but Korea, even more dangerous, and then the feel of things between these two countries.
Well, I think we're at a in an interesting moment. We have a president, vice president, and a secretary of state, none of whom have any foreign policy experience. And they nevertheless have large challenges. The Chinese team, on the other hand, is well built out, as it were, with a deep bench in all of these areas, just refreshed, in fact. And so the hope is, by those who tell me about it, from both China and the United States, is the hope is that the personal relationship between Trump and Xi will be the key to the future of our relationship. If that's true, then let us hope that that relationship will allow for real, a truly statesman-like approach to the enduring and dangerous problem of Korea, for example.
Who's leading that dance? Start with Korea.
Well, basically, sadly, Mr. Kim is leading that dance in Korea. Young Mr. Kim, who in Chinese, if you talk to a Chinese taxi driver, they call Kim Jin San Pang, Kim the Third, the Fat One. There's not much respect for North Korea in the Chinese popular opinion, but the Chinese government has tolerated and indeed exacerbated this crisis by its toleration of North Korea and its nuclear armament in a way that is, in my view, very counterproductive to China's national interests. Does China really want a South Korea or a Japan with nuclear weapons? It's time for China to get control over this issue, not just the United States. It's in many ways a more dangerous situation for China than it is for the United States.
What are they ready to do you suppose?
Very good question. So far, they've been ready to do almost nothing. And yet I believe that both in elite public opinion and more broadly described public opinion, there's a view that it is time for their policy toward North Korea to change. And Chinese policy can change, as we saw yesterday, on a dime. Chinese policy towards South Korea, very antagonistic over the last year about the THAAD missile deployment by the United States and South Korea. Right. There, yesterday they said, as the New York Times put it, oh, never mind. Let's go back to being friends as we were before this crisis. And that's a realization of a mistaken foreign policy. You know, it's not easy to have poor relations with both Koreas, but China has managed that art remarkably well under President Xi.
We've talked on this program about this before. What stands in the way from China's point of view of ending the Korean War finally and getting the nukes out, North and South?
Well, I think there's a...
Ours and theirs.
I think a residual element is, of course, the military having once fought in North Korea. There's some sense of that. Probably more powerful than that. It's the last... one of the last communist countries, not too many communist friends left for Mr. Xi in this regard. But I would also say that if there could be a longer-term vision on the part of China and the United States of a unified Korea under the South, the North will disappear in time, and the Americans then have to agree to withdraw their troops and go home. No Chinese government. If Chiang Kai-shek came back to life tomorrow, he would not want American troops in Korea. No Chinese government wishes that long term. But it takes statesmanship, vision, and tenacity on the side of many. And of course, great skill, because it's a dangerous situation in North Korea.
People, scuttlebutt spoke, hints that there are two Trump presences in these talks with Xi Jinping. One is hardcore America First. Bannon, they're cleaning our clock. It's bad time. We've got to stand up to China. The other, more accommodationist, globalist, what's to choose here? And how? Who's going to prevail?
I don't see on the American side much globalism, although the Chinese side has embraced it on a wide variety of fronts, including the environment. I imagine we will see coming out of this some big trade deals that will be announced that probably would have happened anyway. But it would be announced, and they will redound to Mr. Trump's credit, or at least he will take credit for them. There may be some energy deals, Chinese investment, you know, in the Gulf or in Texas. Sinopec seems poised for a contract there. You'll see some of that element. You'll probably see some mutual admiration among strongmen. We're in a world in which it appears that the major countries are led by people who like to view themselves and be viewed as strongmen. And certainly both of these individuals would merit that term.
Where would you expect the Chinese to lead in these talks, to break ground, to take new initiatives?
I don't see the Chinese necessarily wishing to take a whole range of new initiatives with an American government, say, on the environment that is not interested in pursuing them. I think Chinese leadership will come after, in many ways, after this particular meeting in all the areas we were discussing at the beginning, in entrepreneurship, in education, such as a place like Tsinghua University, and also in infrastructure. My dearest hope is that Mr. Xi takes Mr. Trump for a ride on a high-speed train in
Wouldn't
China.
That be something?
And finally, Mr. Trump would understand what modern infrastructure can look like.
Speak of entrepreneurship and then education as places where China does lead in certain ways.
Certainly can lead. If you again look at Tsinghua, Tsinghua was a place that was founded to send Chinese students to the United States.
That's where that photograph was taken, right?
That's right. That's where this photograph comes from. And Tsinghua today, thanks to Tsinghua University and American philanthropy, Mr. Schwartzman, is now home to Schwartzman College, which is aspirationally the Rhodes Scholarship of the 21st century, with the idea, it's a pretty amazing idea, that the future leaders of the world will not want to take a Rhodes Scholarship. They won't want to go to a rainy, cold island off the coast of Europe. They're going to go to Beijing. We shall see, but it's off to a fantastic start.
And what about primary education with these famously studious, serious, purposeful, successful Chinese kids?
Well, in urban areas in China, which is now more than half of the country, primary education is, you know, stronger year by year by year. It has some of the best public schools in the world. There's enormous, in China, as in the United States, education inequality, depending on where you live. But educational opportunity from first grade through graduate school is growing very fast.
Are you imagining another tour day for our president in schools, for example?
You know, it would be great for him to go to Beida, for Peking University, or Tsinghua, and look at universities that may well be global leaders in the 21st century.
Bill Kirby is our guest in the studio, China historian at the Harvard Business School. Coming up, the American legend Chaz Freeman, translator between Richard Nixon and Chairman Mao at the opening of an era in 1972, speaking about where we're at today. This is Open Source. Donald Trump and Xi Jinping in China next week are 45 years down a road that opened in front of our guest, Chaz Freeman. He was the Foreign Service officer at the start of his own brilliant career, translating the breakthrough meetings with Henry Kissinger, Zhou Enlai, President Nixon, and Chairman Mao. I asked Chaz Freeman this week for a fresh take on China's needs and wants with new leaders in a new century.
They want to go on with their business without having unnecessary irritation and fights with the United States. And what is their business? It is continuing to reorganize and redirect their economy, perfecting a police state on a level that no one's ever seen because it involves hooking big data in with artificial intelligence and connecting facial recognition technology to cameras everywhere, to credit card records, to internet browsing records, to medical records, to government IDs, to hospital analyses, to foreign travel, and so forth and so on.
In fairness, we're learning a bit of that monster in our own world.
Yeah, in our case, you can argue whether it's better or worse because we have institutions like credit bureaus, which are really not responsible to anyone and very lightly regulated and not very safe, as we've just learned, that accumulate most of this information. And if you've watched a demonstration of big data, you will know that they can pinpoint pretty much any individual in the United States and formulate a sales pitch for that person that will appeal to his or her psychology. When you add facial recognition technology to this, and perhaps drones, you've got the most effective system of social and economic control that has ever been seen. And that's on the verge of coming into being.
Fascinating thing in that picture, Chaz Freeman, was that our guys, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, all of them were hand in hand with the Chinese. Is this a different project over there than it is here, or vice versa?
It's the same technology. In the Chinese case, it's not for profit because it is government and Communist Party run. It is for purposes of political and social control, or the very Confucian purpose, they would say, of promoting virtue in citizens. So you'll get a score rating your trustworthiness, the extent to which you support national objectives, to which you are critical of the government or supportive. And if you get a high score, you will get benefits. And if you get a low score, you will be deprived of benefits. So you will have a powerful incentive to toe the line. This is Mr. Xi's China. And he wants to not get into a fight with the United States over foreign affairs. He wants to keep the U.S. from carrying out an attack on North Korea. And he wants to retain influence with Mr. Trump to that end. And he's doing a good job of building it. So I suspect that the visit, if you combine the anticipated snow job with the ability that Mr. Xi has shown to ingratiate himself with Mr. Trump, we're going to see, barring an accident, some sort of major strengthening of this relationship. And it will be dotted with commercial gifts. That's why the 40 thieves are there. If I were a left-wing person, I would be aghast.
Chaz Freeman, you sat there as translator between Mao and Richard Nixon in the early 70s. Imagine Xi Jinping, Donald J. Trump, take you aside, say, Chaz, give me the word on Trump here, says Mr. Xi. And Trump says, Chaz, while you're at it, tell me about Mr. Xi.
I don't think the Chinese have any trouble understanding Mr. Trump. All they have to do is read a psychological profile of malignant narcissism, and they've basically got it. In the case of Mr. Xi, you have someone who is extraordinarily self-controlled, a wily, strategic thinker, who has come up through a system that is very unforgiving to those who stumble. And he has just consolidated a level of prominence in the Chinese system that really has not been seen for decades. I'm not going to say that he is more powerful than Deng Xiaoping, although that is the current narrative, but he certainly enjoys greater prominence. I mean, Mr. Deng's position was the chairman of the Chinese Bridge Association. Mr. Xi is the general secretary of the party, which has been greatly strengthened and purged under his leadership, and also the president of the country, and the commander of its armed forces, the chief national security official, the main economic planner, and the author of strategic schemes like the Belt and Road Initiative. So you're dealing with someone who's tough, knows what he wants, which is basically, as I said, to keep the United States from becoming too much of an irritant as China moves forward.
I asked Chaz Freeman the Bill Kirby question. Can China lead?
I think if you're asking the question, does China aspire to the sort of global leadership that the United States enjoyed in the so-called free world during the Cold War or in the so-called unipolar moment after it, I think the answer is clearly no. China has not shown any aspiration for that level of hegemonic control of world affairs. I think it is psychologically ill-suited to that. And I think many Chinese would regard attempting to take such a leading role as a mistake. That said, Mr. Xi is far more self-confident and assertive and not prepared to allow Chinese interests to be crossed in the way that he might believe they've been crossed before. So we're dealing with a China that can say no, a China that can develop its own agenda and push for it, and a China that will not wait for us to join it if we don't push ahead on its own.
Chaz, you introduced us to One Belt, One Road, what was it, 2-3 years ago. What does that mean for the future of the world? Africa, Eastern Hemisphere, Western Hemisphere, all of us.
Well, it's basically a grand offer of finance and engineering skills to create a totally connected Eurasian landmass from Portugal to the Bering Strait, from Moscow to Colombo, and peripheral areas like East Africa as well, included in this network of 80,000 kilometers, 50,000 miles of high-speed rail, comparable mileage of superhighways, fiber optic cable pipelines, airfields, ports, industrial estates, all of it open. An environment in which China believes its own dynamism and size will naturally give it a preeminent role. And since the United States has chosen to stand aside from this and doesn't really offer anything by way of competition for it in terms of capital engineering skills, foreign assistance, or other such things, the United States will end up sidelined on our side of the Atlantic or Pacific, as the case might be, not part of this scheme, and therefore in a sort of secondary position in global affairs. But that will take decades. This is not a military imperial push. It's not even mercantilist. It is a very Chinese vision of civic virtue at home, leading others to want to emulate you and follow you and respect you. It's about respect, dignity, prestige, not about control.
You see this coming yourself?
Yes, I have been following this with great interest from the beginning. It began as the opportunistic exploitation of production surpluses of steel, cement, aluminum, other construction materials, and the fact that the China market no longer required that level of production, and therefore it was logical to look for markets abroad. That was the beginning of it. But some very clever person around Mr. Xi saw that out of this you could create a geoeconomic strategy that would propel China to the heights of global affairs.
That is the very tough-minded professional servant of our government, former Ambassador Chaz Freeman. Bill Kirby, so many points to talk about there. Starting, he's very brazen about calling it a police state. Let's get real.
Yeah, and he's
totally
And you'll be rated
on your Confucian scale.
Right. I think one other thing that Chaz might have said in that context is Mr. Xi's main accomplishment over the last 5 years, apart from building his own power base to such a remarkable degree, and basically his mission in political life has been to restore the authority of the party. And within China, much of what he has done has to do with restoring the authority of the party, the respect of the party, the ethics of the party, by a man who, believe it or not, really does, I think, believe in that the Chinese Communist Party, as imagined back in the 1950s when he was a kid, was above all a force for good. This means ignoring large parts of the history of the Chinese Communist Party, but his central accomplishment these last 5 years would be to strengthen the party, not necessarily in the same vein or with the same energy, the country.
But he has these tools, these technological, intrusive, mind-reading tools that Mao never imagined. I'm wondering, you know, is there anything—
And that is part of party control. There's no question about it. And it can now go into almost, if they wish, into every classroom in every school.
Is there anything left of a human rights agenda or critique of China?
Sadly, there's very little. There's very little resonance of it abroad, and the suppression of alternative opinions at home has been so harsh and so unrelenting, much to China's detriment. China is a country that has, of course, great thinkers, has always had great thinkers, has had innovative thinkers, but they now cannot speak and they cannot publish at home, and it is a great— it's a great loss to China because China loses the alternative ideas of where this country will need to go in some post-communist future, but it also is a source of great shame to have imprisoned and to have died in prison Liu Xiaobo, a great and courageous man who did no harm to any person or any piece of property, but died for his beliefs.
For me, for the future, it takes me back to that picture, though. All of those interlocking super tech companies that know your needs and desires and fantasies better than you do, all at the command of the state.
And indeed, willingly, if you look at Mr. Zuckerberg, shamelessly seeking to get into China on any possible terms.
You know, about the Xi Jinping presence in the air everywhere in China, I had the pleasure of a voicemail this morning, Bill, from a remarkable student of yours in China, Adam Frost, who's at home, you know, native speaker by now, talking to everybody. And he says you feel Chairman Xi's politics everywhere.
In Beijing, you can actually see physical manifestations of Xi Jinping thought. If you walk around the heart of the city today through the old hutongs that surround Tiananmen and the Forbidden City, you'll see nothing but scaffolding and sheet metal walls. It looks as if they're doing some major renovations to the hutongs, but what you are actually seeing is a political purge. Residents and small business owners, especially those without local residence permits, are getting pushed out of the first and second and third ring roads to the outskirts of the city. This is part of the central government's effort to hollow out the core of the capital and transform it into a dedicated seat of politics. We see this centrality of politics being reflected now in social media, in universities, and the workplace. Under Xi Jinping, many aspects of life have become increasingly politicized, and politics have taken a decidedly authoritarian turn. And we should only expect to see more of these radical transformations during Xi's second term in office.
Bill Kirby, that's your man, Adam Frost, in Beijing today.
Yes.
What do you want to add to Chaz Freeman's profile of Xi Jinping?
Well, I would say the one other, Mr. Xi has taken on so many titles, so many more titles than anyone before him, including, actually, I guess he's not yet quite the great helmsman as Chairman Mao was. And one wonders if it isn't a little bit of overreach. Over the last 5 years, he has accumulated a great deal of power. He has made a lot of enemies. Hmm. In China, my experience is that when everybody is saying exactly the same thing, as they are saying today in the same slogans, that's when there's real disagreement. And not all members of the Chinese Communist Party or non-party members agree with this direction or agree that the future of China is going to be determined by Xi Jinping thought for a new era of China with with socialist character, socialism with Chinese characteristics. He's chairman of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, responsible for everything. The premier, an able man, is not really given, as his predecessors were, central responsibility over the economy. That's now Xi Jinping's responsibility. Public security is his responsibility. Foreign affairs is his responsibility. Party building, of course. Corruption is his responsibility. Everything is his responsibility.
Social media, university professorships. I mean,
things better go very well for Mr. Xi because there's an assumption of an all-inclusive power that is there for the ultimate goal of the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, as he put it, the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. But, you know, that's doesn't happen overnight. China's return to the power status globally that it would have had two centuries ago. It is getting there. I think it would get there in any event without necessarily this high concentration of power at the center. China is going to thrive. His mission over the last 5 years is to make sure that the Chinese Communist Party remains central to China's future. That's not automatic.
Did he miss a turn toward the sort of liberalization that we think of as vital?
We may think of it as vital.
Will the opportunity come again?
It may. You never know in these political systems what people actually think, but there's really nothing in his past record and certainly no evidence in the past 5 years that Xi Jinping is somehow a secret Gorbachev or secretly seeking, you know, imagining a China that will open up and bloom politically as it has economically. That, I think, is wishful thinking.
Artistically? Scientifically?
Scientifically, for sure. Artistically, within proper political bounds.
I just wonder, what's the limit that he's pushing here?
It's a very good question. You have to assume, and this is the big risk on his point, people are now studying, they have to study his speeches, his thought, his sishang in Chinese. There aren't a lot of ideas in this area beside the assertion of state control and state power and Marxism as he understands it to be. And so the distance, and this is the risk, in a highly entrepreneurial, increasingly educated and sophisticated culture of the major cities of China, the distance between people, what they know is true and what they are told is true, gets larger every day.
Quickly, what about Chaz Freeman's point that this gigantic One Belt, One Road program began with a surplus in concrete?
Totally true. They still have one. Yeah, that's one reason why it will continue.
We got too much concrete on hand in the inventory. Let's take over the world.
Infrastructure export. Would that we have excess infrastructure materials in this country?
We're talking about China as Donald Trump and Xi Jinping get ready to meet for the first time. Bill Kirby is our guest in the studio. Coming up, cultural contests inside the power game, issues around freedom, respect, happiness. This is Open Source. President Trump is in China next week with mixed motives and a long agenda, trade rules without a TPP, North Korea's nukes, and global warming, which he used to say was a Chinese invention. Bill Kirby is our guest, China historian based at the Harvard Business School. We are interested in cultural puzzles too, Bill, like how's to feel about a gigantic business enterprise sometimes called Chimerica that spans a vast gap of language, history, emotion, respect. I put it to the bilingual and profoundly bicultural Kaiser Guo, a music and media star in China who now hosts his Sinica podcast on all things Chinese from a home base in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Well, I think what's evolving is something that has a lot of deep pathologies. It's a codependent organism, or it's a couple of organisms that aren't symbiotic as so much as they are codependent in an unhealthy way. And I think one of them is freeing itself of that codependence faster than the other is. China's rise has been almost wholly predicated on being able to tap American consumerism. It's really between the great saver and the great spender. I mean, there's one country that saves maybe even too much, and the other that spends well beyond its means. Basically, they've enabled one another and made possible China's rise, but also has really sort of fueled a lot of the problems that led to the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, and the Great Recession. Mm. I think what we're seeing right now is something we've not really, simply as Americans, we've never encountered before, which is actually dealing with a peer. In the lifetimes of almost any American alive today, there has been no peer. There has been no country that the United States can look to and feel genuinely like, you know, you might offer a different way of being modern in this world that works, that may be an alternative that, say, other developing countries might find compelling. Mm-hmm. That's where we are. And the audience, if there's an audience, is Latin America, it's Sub-Saharan Africa, it's the Middle East and North Africa, it's Southeast Asia, it's, to an extent, the Indian subcontinent, it's the countries of Central Asia. And, you know, honestly, even Eastern Europe.
What do young people in China see in the way of alternative models?
I think that there's still an awful lot that attracts a good number of young Chinese people about elements of the so-called Western model. I think that certainly there's very little question that the rise of China, the generation of all this wealth, the simple betterment of lives, has owed an awful lot to market economics. And insofar as that is a Western creation, then they certainly agree with that. there are a lot of elements of personal liberty that I think young Chinese certainly admire, want for themselves. But I think that we flatter ourselves to think that they all have aspirations to enjoy the full range of political liberties that we do, or at least that they would so value those that ultimate sacrifices, that huge personal sacrifices are warranted or are seen as worthwhile.
That's Kaiser Guo in North Carolina. Bill Kirby, interesting points there. Codependency, not symbiosis. And Chinese consumers loving the freedom of choice at the mall, but not ready to fight for political freedom.
Not ready at the moment, or certainly not having also the institutions with which to contend for mm-hmm. political participation. The risks are, of course, extraordinarily great. I thought what Kaiser said was extraordinarily important, looking at China as a peer. And it's very important. Americans so seldom, you know, well, these are two great countries and two nearly continental-sized countries that themselves are, for the most part, inward-looking and historically don't necessarily, at least in the Chinese case, see others as peers. And because, in fact, historically, in Chinese history, there weren't, by and large, peers to be had for this longest continuous civilization in world history. But for the United States, it takes the both courage and intellectual capacity to look at ourselves as the way others look at us and to have a sense that not all is as we imagine it. So China is a peer in many, many areas. And, of course, in the cultural realm, in the economic realm and so on, it's a partner from which we learn, a partner which is all around us, given the large number, like Kaiser Guo, of Chinese who live all over the world. Mm-hmm. China has the great cultural advantage of having an extraordinary diaspora of cultural and economic talent all over the world, which will reconnect on periodic basis back with China. It's a secret ingredient, as it were, for China's remarkable recovery after the disasters of the Maoist period.
And then there's this happiness question in China, the matter of human well-being. Ian Johnson, and you know him well, is a Pulitzer Prize winner for the Wall Street Journal. He's gone native for half a lifetime in China, reporting a spiritual crisis and a revival in the last decade. We have talked at length about his book, The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, and again this week about Chinese values today.
When Xi Jinping took power 5 years ago, China was in the middle of a real moral abyss, a moral void. People felt that there was no minimum moral standards in the country. And although overseas people tend to think of Xi Jinping as a strong man or for his foreign policy moves, etc., inside China, people really value that he's taken this moral issue and made it front and center of his domestic policy. He's taken on corruption. He's challenged the corrupt officials in the government. He's pushed traditional values. This sort of thing goes over really well, and it helps explain why he's such a popular leader.
It's about the personal dimension of those traditional values is what?
Well, these traditional values are foremost family life, community values, a communitarian lifestyle. This is something people really feel is missing. Don't forget, up until not too recently, about 80% of Chinese lived in the countryside. Now it's 50-50. So you've had hundreds of millions of people have moved into these big anonymous cities. There's a widespread feeling of uncertainty in how to live in a city. Who are your friends? Who are your neighbors? What do people stand for? Even inside the cities themselves, a lot of traditional neighborhoods have broken down and so on. And I think what these religious values do and the things that Xi Jinping has been pushing is to try to recreate a sense of value inside society.
You're saying that is rebounding with Xi Jinping.
Yeah, I think he's pushing that idea at least. He's got big propaganda campaigns that have been going on for 5 years, pushing these sort of ideas. And if you think of it in the bigger picture, this is not such a great sign for China in a way. Real innovation doesn't come, I think, from towing the line and kissing the government's rear end. I think it comes from having creative people being set free to do things. This is also the problem with the Xi Jinping policies. Xi Jinping is pushing this kind of stability, pushing these traditional values, which people appreciate. But at the same time, he's pushing ideological conformity and purity. And in the long run, this is not really helpful.
That's Ian Johnson in China This Week. Bill Kirby, how do the values survive, prosper in the police state, as Chaz Freeman called it?
Yeah, that's a great question, because if the values, for example, of having honest and upright officials, a long-standing Confucian, as well as a value that every country wished were practiced by its own officials. The way in which corruption is being dealt with in China, it's being dealt with very brutally, very politically. Mm-hmm. But in my view, it's not sustainable, because the corruption exists in Chinese officialdom because officials are paid so little that they cannot possibly live off an official salary. And so it's expected that they have to have some form of extra or the family has to have some form of extra income in order to live an official life. Mm. You can always cashier somebody for corruption. Hence, Mr. Xi's personal salary is something around $22,500 as president of the country. We pay our graduate students at Harvard more than that. So, you know, it's always easy to get, but unless there's an honest judiciary, an honest police system, unpoliticized, ideally a more open press, three measures that would do more to relieve corruption than every anti-corruption team that the Chinese Communist Party can muster, then I don't see this as anything other than a temporary hammering down of a set of nails that in time will pop back up.
Bill, I want to come back to a point you were making earlier about these two huge, rather inward-looking, maybe standoffish, giant, continent-sized powers. Maybe they don't want to get to know each other better, but I'm also remembering the thrill of even the ping pong players. Back, was that 80s? But,
right. You know, Boston. Seventies, early 70s.
Boston Symphony playing in Beijing. These were big events. Meryl Streep, Yo-Yo Ma, others going on sort of artistic missions to China. It felt great. Will we ever see that again?
Oh, yes. And I think it happens all the time. And the fact that it happens all the time now means that it isn't a special event. You know, Chaz was the translator for President Nixon in 1972. I always assigned to my business school students the memorandum of the conversation between Mao and Nixon. And I asked them to tell me, what do these guys say about trade between the United States and China? And of course, the students are dumbstruck because they say nothing about trade. Mm-hmm. Mao and Nixon didn't care, actually, about trade between China and the United States. And neither of them could have imagined, and Mao would not have condoned, the world in which we now live. But it is said very frequently on political terms that the United States and China, this is a Chinese phrase, are tong chuang yi meng. We sleep in the same bed, but we have different dreams, different lovers, as it were.
That's good.
But in fact, we are embedded together. We're embedded together economically, crucially. We're embedded culturally and educationally. Chinese universities are rising fast to be both the rivals and the partners of the American higher educational system. We are embedded in every possible dimension in trying, one hopes, even under Mr. Trump, to solve global problems like global warming.
Bill, also this week we touched base with a respected education reformer in Beijing. Jiang Xuechin is Chinese to the bone, with a Yale undergraduate degree as well. Listen to this.
What I find in working with Chinese students is that they're extremely hardworking. They're really dedicated to learning. And what I find lacking is what we call emotional intelligence, resilience, empathy. The emotional skills that students will need to navigate the 21st century global economy, the Chinese schools are not very good at teaching. You can make the argument that what the Chinese schools do, and they've done this very well for the past few decades, is teaching majority of Chinese students basic numeracy and literacy skills in order to be micromanaged by bureaucrats, basically to make them factory workers in a socialist economy. Of course, nowadays, because of globalization, because of IT, because of artificial intelligence, these skills are now out of date. And what we're finding is that Chinese schools are having a very tough time transitioning to a more student-centered model in which students can develop the emotional skills, the ability to work together, the ability to think out of a box, the ability to ask questions.
Math and science, emotional intelligence, Bill, what's to cultivate here?
Well, it's not wrong to think that the Chinese are extraordinarily good at math and science and trained to do so from an early age. But you see real innovation in Chinese education today in major universities. Every major university is now experimenting with a program in the liberal arts and sciences because they believe what we say, that we educate leaders not in narrow specializations, but people to be problem solvers for the rest of their lives. And so next year, a year from now, opening in the town of Kunshan, outside of Shanghai, Duke University will open a four-year liberal arts college that has the most innovative liberal arts curriculum I have ever seen. Now, how this...
What's the mark of it?
So the mark of it is really what is called rooted globalism. You have to know where you're from, but you have to be curious about the rest of the world culturally, economically, politically, and so on. And you have to have the capacity to see your own country, once again, as others see it.
You know, that fellow, Jiang Suiqin, who guided me around Beijing 3 years ago, he made a wonderful point to me about the feeling level this week, the feeling level between two distant people. He said his sort of prediction was that the Chinese elite in the next generation will be led by people who went to Harvard and Yale. But they will come back to China feeling scars and slights that they suffered in America, and they will be more nationalist Chinese than otherwise. Does that make sense to you?
Well,
Do you know people like that? I think he's one of them, frankly.
People at Harvard and Yale have imagined that their graduates would be leading China for a very long period of time, and it hasn't yet happened. Although we have, in both cases, and in many great colleges and universities around the country, educated people who became leaders of different Chinas over the course of the 20th century. My guess is at the moment, this gets back to Mr. Xi Jinping. Right now, the Chinese Communist Party, for great talent coming from abroad, is a closed shop. These people will be leaders in industry. They'll be leaders in education, those who are trained at the great and in a broad range of American colleges and universities. But the way things are stacking up at the moment, they are unlikely to be leaders in the political realm.
Do we believe, as Zhang Suiqin was saying, that emotional intelligence, all those intangible, charm, personal ways are on the rise in Xi's China, or will they survive in Xi's China?
Well, I think you know, there's this broad stereotype that he's pushing against quite rightly, that the Americans are somehow by birth innovators and the Chinese are rote thinkers. You don't have the longest continuous civilization in world history without reinventing yourself now and again.
So the modern answer to the can China lead question is what, in a minute or so?
The modern answer is economically, yes. In terms of science and technology, yes. Educationally, yes. Politically, not without some major political reform. China has an early 20th century European political system in the Leninist, Stalinist, Maoist system to which Mr. Xi is heir and which he wishes to strengthen. Mm-hmm. That is not a recipe for global leadership.
High-speed rail, yes. Many kinds of education, yes. Distinctive enterprises,
yes.
That you keep studying.
Yes.
Company by company.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In almost every realm. But again, here in the United States, this is not a moment in which we can look at our own political system, at least from my point of view, with great pride.
Yeah, even our business performance. Bill Kirby, thank you so much. Thank you, Kaiser Guo, Jiang Suiqin, Ian Johnson, Chaz Freeman, and Adam Frost. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Becca DiGregorio, Susan Coyne, Frank Horton. George Hicks is our engineer, with help from Paul Kahlo. Mary McGrath is our One Belt, One Road I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time on Open Source.